You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 21st of January 2015 on Monocle 24, the Monocle Daily in association with UBS.
Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to the Monocle Daily here on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller.
Coming up in tonight's programme.
More than 9,000 troops of Russian Federation on my territory, including more than 500 tanks and heavy artillery and armed personnel carrier. If this is not an aggression, what is the aggression?
Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko's allegation that Russia has invaded his country is followed inevitably by Russia's denial that it has done any such thing. As fighting escalates nevertheless, we'll ask if today's talks in Berlin are likely to accomplish much.
Also coming up.
Billionaires come to Davos to do is to talk to corporate leaders and mostly political leaders from other countries to get a sense of what is the global landscape that they're going to have to navigate through in the next 12 months.
1,700 private jets, Pharrell Williams, and a mission to save the world. We get a snapshot of Davos from Bloomberg's Matt Miller.
And later in the programme.
The animals went in two by two, hurrah, hurrah. The animals went in two by two, hurrah, hurrah.
JFK Airport is getting a new terminal exclusively for pets and other livestock, and yes, it's called the Ark. We'll hear from one of the architects behind it.
All that and music as well, that's all coming up right here on the Monocle Daily, live from London, here on Monocle 24. But before we get launched on all that, Suzanne Chislett starts the next 60 minutes for us with the latest world news.
Monocle 24 News. Ukraine has accused Russia of sending 9,000 troops and 500 tanks across the shared border to join pro-separatist rebels. The Ukrainian military says it's fighting Russian soldiers near the eastern city of Luhansk. President Petro Poroshenko cut short a visit to Davos to return home. Mary Dayevsky is a columnist with The Independent. She told Monocle 24 it's hard to see how this situation will satisfactorily play out.
This business of Russian troops, we don't know whether there are actually Russian troops there or whether there are Russian volunteers. And when you think about the situation in Syria and Iraq, there is a distinction between people who are part of the national armed forces, such as Russian armed forces, and volunteers going there off their own bat.
The French government has announced an increase on security spending to prevent more terror attacks. €425 million will be used to recruit more than 2,500 personnel to police, justice, intelligence and defence sectors following the Paris shootings. At least 10 people have been stabbed in an apparent terror attack on a bus in Tel Aviv in Israel. The government says a Palestinian man who was shot in the leg as he tried to flee was to blame. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has accepted an invitation to address a joint meeting of the US Congress next month. The invite came not from the White House, but from the House of Representatives Speaker John Boehner. He took the decision to ask Netanyahu to speak about radical Islam and the threat from Iran, hours after President Obama criticized some lawmakers for wanting to pass new sanctions against Tehran, which he said would jeopardize progress in the nuclear talks.
I did not consult with the White House. The Congress can make this decision on its own. I don't believe I'm poking anyone in the eye. There is a serious threat that exists in the world. And the president last night kind of papered over it. And the fact is that there needs to be a more serious conversation in America about how serious the threat is from radical Islamic jihadists and the threat posed by Iran.
The highest level U.S. delegation to Cuba in 35 years has begun talks with counterparts in Havana. They're focusing on immigration and restoring diplomatic ties between the two nations. The discussions follow the announcement last month that Presidents Barack Obama and Raul Castro reached a deal to end Cold War-era hostilities. Gustavo Mackin speaks for the Cuban Foreign Ministry.
Well, the two delegations has been talking on a very respectful way. We have been analyzing or exchanging about the migration trends between our two countries. I think that we have many points of coincidence, you know, in the way we are dealing.
Two Turkish policemen have been jailed for 10 years for their part in beating a student to death during anti-government protests that Turkish leader Tayyip Erdogan described at the time as a coup attempt. Police used tear gas after the sentences were announced to disperse protesters outside the courthouse in the central town of Kayseri. The family of 19-year-old Ali İsmail Korkmaz has criticized the sentences as too lenient, while supporters of the officers say their treatment has been unjust. The leader of the fast-growing German anti-Islam movement, Pegida, has resigned after a photo emerged of him posing as Hitler. Prosecutors were also investigating Lutz Bachmann over allegations he incited hatred for calling refugees scumbags. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Suzanne. And I, for one, am shocked, I tell you, that anybody associated with the Pegida movement could turn out to be a somewhat unsavoury crank harbouring delusional far-right tendencies.
Couldn't happen to a nicer man.
It's astonishing, it really is.
The time is 6 minutes past the hour.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Uit London, dit is Monocle 24.
Fra London, dit is Monocle 24.
From London, dit is Londres.
Hollanda.
London,
Europe.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
Speaking at the World Economic Forum in Davos today, the Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko claimed more than 9,000 Russian soldiers, accompanied by 500 artillery pieces and armoured vehicles, were currently deployed in the east of his country. This was followed by Moscow's routine denial that a single Russian boot print is to be found on Ukrainian soil.
Someone is fighting Ukraine's defence forces, however, and with increasing ferocity. Fighting in and around the rebel stronghold of Donetsk today killed at least 5 civilians and injured 30 others. Talks on de-escalating the conflict, which began in Berlin earlier this evening, appear to have little to work with. With us here in the studio is Andrew Foxall, director of the Russia Studies Centre at the Henry Jackson Society here in London. Andrew, I wanted to ask, first of all, it's a question we've asked a few times about Moscow's approach to the fighting in Ukraine. Their policy, and it must be a policy, of denying what is obvious to anybody with eyes. How is it working for them?
Well, I mean, I would just begin really by noting that there is in eastern Ukraine a very real humanitarian crisis taking place. Over 1 million people have been displaced internally. Over 7,000 people have died since the beginning of the conflict. And beyond that, of course, hundreds of thousands of people are without access to really very basic social services and so on and so forth. So there is an important human factor to this beyond the negotiations and what is often seen really, I think, as a sort of power play between Russia and the West. Incorrectly, though, I think. But in terms of, starting to answer your question, in terms of how this plays in Russia, it plays relatively well to Putin's domestic audience, which is to say his traditional electorate. The great majority of the Russian people, because of the intense nature by which the Kremlin, the pro-Kremlin media in Russia portray this story, support Putin wholeheartedly. They support Russia's actions in Ukraine. They support the idea that Kiev is overrun by a sort of fascist haunter that is seeking to, as part of this wider Western conspiracy, seeking to undercut and undermine Russia internationally.
To what degree, though, you were talking about the people in Ukraine who are clearly at the sharpest end of any kind of geopolitical discord that's happening higher up. But when the accusations started to fly about the presence of Russian soldiers or Russian troops, it was thought that 7% of Ukraine is now occupied, to all intents and purposes, by Russia, which makes up to 20% of the population of Ukraine. To what degree is this actually a conflict that is being fought on the ground? And the fact is that the Russian presence is actually going to exacerbate any kind of internal crises that are going to be happening in Ukraine.
Absolutely. I mean, there are a number of aspects to this, I think, that really ought to be fleshed out. First of all, one aspect is that is that in eastern Ukraine, there are individuals or groups of people who are anti-Kiev rather than being pro-Moscow. At the same time, there are groups who are both pro-Moscow and anti-Kiev. Those groups that are anti-Kiev and pro-Moscow are not necessarily all under the control of the Kremlin. They're not this sort of homogenous group or groupings of organizations that are orchestrated by Moscow. That being said, Moscow undoubtedly supports and to a certain extent enables what is happening in eastern Ukraine. And I think we, just by looking at the troop movements over recent days by Russian forces, not only in eastern Ukraine, but also in Russia, in southwestern Russia, which is, say, the part of Russia that borders Ukraine, it's pretty obvious, I think, that the reason for the escalation is really Russia's recent actions.
So are these talks, at least as far as Russia's concerned, are these talks in Berlin likely to go anywhere, or is Russia just turning up because it's the sort of thing they should look like they're doing?
I think that genuine hopes for a viable solution or really viable hopes for anything to come out of this ought to be pretty low. I think it would be fair to say that if Russia was serious about wanting a peace plan in eastern Ukraine and wanting peace in Ukraine, then we would have it already. I think there are signs over recent days, if not recent weeks, that Russia's position on Ukraine, eastern Ukraine, is softening. For example, the idea of a land bridge between Crimea and eastern Ukraine and Russia seems really to have fallen off the Kremlin's narrative at the moment. President Putin no longer refers to those regions in eastern Ukraine as part of this Novorossiya, or New Russia, project. He instead refers to Luhansk and Donetsk as People's Republics. Now, in the grand scheme of things, that's not to, you know, underplay the role that the Kremlin has played in the events in eastern Ukraine. But it is to suggest, I think, that now more than any time, that perhaps Putin is looking for a way out of this.
Well, you say that, and you're talking about trying to interpret signs, but the Ukrainian authorities who've made the same claim that 9,000 Russians were in their country also said that it was impossible to read any signs, because not only did they know what Vladimir Putin was intending to do next, they didn't really think that Vladimir Putin knew what he was going to do next.
Well, you're quite right. If nothing else is clear over the Ukraine crisis itself, it is that trying to second guess or double guess or triple guess what Putin is trying to do is really a pointless exercise.
Andrew Foxhall, Director of the Russia Studies Centre at the Henry Jackson Society, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Who said print was dead? Certainly none of the guests who sit down with Tyler Brulé and Tom Edwards to dissect the best and brightest, glowing and glossiest in the magazine industry. Every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time, Studio One at Midori House can play host to art directors and publishers, photographers and columnists as they flick through their favourite journals, shred some of the periodicals they could do without, and dispense snippets of industry gossip.
Our paper is incredibly expensive and it's imported from Italy. And we had that discussion about the paper, but actually we decided the paper is too important. It's just too important that it looks good, that it's consistent. It's a little bit like hymn book paper, and it creates the impression that we've been around for a very, very, very long time.
Occasionally, they also offer up some sharp opinions on where this turbulent sector might be heading. Join Tyler Brulé or Tom Edwards when Tyler's on the road for The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly print industry review and analysis show, every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Make it part of your must-listen lineup on iTunes or SoundCloud.
You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson. The annual World Economic Forum is underway in Davos, once again prompting widespread mystification at the spectacle of a conclave of super wealthy plutocrats choosing to get together in Switzerland in January as opposed to somewhere sunny.
Switzerland, as opposed to, well, it is sunny.
It's just also very cold, well, is my point.
We didn't make that point.
No.
Okay. Anyway, earlier Monocle's Marcus Hippie caught up with Matt Miller, managing editor of Bloomberg Billionaires, who's at the summit. Marcus asked Matt what it's like when a group of billionaires get together.
When there's a lot of billionaires in the room, there's a lot of things to talk about. And right now we have oil, we have Ukraine, we have terrorism, we have low interest rates, and interest rates even falling even lower. There's a lot of investment opportunity. What billionaires come to Davos to do is to talk to corporate leaders and mostly political leaders from other countries to get a sense of what is the global landscape that they're going to have to navigate through in the next 12 months. And then they're able to use that to sort of know whether that's good for their business, bad for their business, how do they react, how do they invest their companies, so that they can make sure they make the most of the year.
And what is the mood like this year? Obviously, falling oil prices could, in principle, give some reason for optimism. But do you see that there?
To be honest with you, I see a mix of optimism and pessimism. I don't think I see a lot of confusion. There are certainly a lot of billionaires who are optimistic that as long as interest rates remain low and oil prices remain low, that they'll be able to make money in whatever market or industry that they operate in. But there's certainly another flip side to that coin. And when you look at billionaires who take a much more sort of geopolitical prism to look at the world through, when they see ISIS and they see the situation in Ukraine flaring up, there's a lot to be worried about. And I think a lot of those billionaires are predicting that the second half of this year will not be as frothy in the markets as they predict the first half to be.
And when you've been following the discussions in Davos this year, what has been the view on the situation with Russia and with Ukraine? For example, how are the sanctions seen at the moment?
From the Russian standpoint, they are taking a very pro-Davos approach and continuing to have parties despite the economic sanctions that are looming over all their companies. They are continuing to try and talk to investors when those investors are allowed to talk to them. I think from the West perspective, it's certainly a little awkward with the Russians. It's sort of one of the elephants in the room. That it used to be that the Russians and the Americans and the Indians and the Chinese and the Africans would all come together and talk about investment in one another's countries. Now that the sanctions are on the table, it's very difficult to have those discussions.
Well, Matthew, tell us when you've been seeing all Russians there. Can you see the sanctions? Are they there on a budget?
No, absolutely not.
I heard already that there's been a few Russian parties. What have you seen going on over there?
Well, last night there was a big VTB party at the Intercontinental Hotel. No expense was spared. There were chocolate ballerinas, caviar, women greeting guests in LED glasses and outfits. Everyone who was anyone was there. It was quite astonishing because no one seemed to give anyone the nod that, hey, this might not be very good from a PR perspective. But from the Russian side, they basically say, look, we have business to do. We have investors that we have to care to. We're a sponsored, a sponsor of the World Economic Forum. We were asked to put on an opening night party, and we did so.
And Matthew, finally, before I let you go, when you are working there in Davos, what are the things you are expecting the most at the moment from the coming days?
I think there's actually going to be a lot of news that's going to be broken over the next couple of days. You can sort of feel it percolating, whether it's deals or, the all of the delegates reacting to myriad issues that are going on in the world, including the escalation in Ukraine. You know, President Poroshenko was here in Davos. He's now heading back to Ukraine this evening to deal with the matter. So I think we'll see a lot of reactionary news out of Davos in the coming days.
That was Monocle's Marcus Hippie talking to Matt Miller about what he expects from Davos this week.
Spirit, love, energy, and culture. To be quickly accessible. Unreroute the river, let the damned water be. There's some people down the way that's thirsty, so let the liquid spirit free.
The weekly culture show on Monocle 24 is where you get your art kicks. Just recently, we've welcomed Tracy Emin, Damien Hirst, and Anish Kapoor to the show. Culture is where you get your musical licks. Just the other day, Gregory Porter, Casey Musgraves and Diane Birch entertained our airwaves. They come round here, then go get their Grammys. Culture is your antidote to everyday arts coverage, featuring reports and interviews from everywhere you didn't know you wanted to get to know, in books, art, music, media, film, and everything from around the world beamed right between your ears. Culture premieres every Monday at 1900 London time, and why not visit monocle.com and iTunes for the archive of over 140 shows. Swing by and hear Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24.
Berlin, I'll say. 22:22 now here in London. Now, several hundred thousand swear words will have been uttered in the last couple of hours here in the United Kingdom as people, myself one of them, struggled to locate the television remote control to record one of the most anticipated dramas for years. The adaptation of Hilary Mantel's Booker Prize-winning novel Wolf Hall features Damian Lewis, liberated from his role as the world's worst scripted terrorist in Homeland, now playing Henry VIII.
But even before opening titles have rolled, a row has begun over just how historically accurate a 650-page work of fiction rewritten for primetime television should be. Henry VIII is arguably England's sexiest monarch when it comes to scandal, six wives, penchant for eating a swan a day, apparently it says here, and the rest of the world is of course equally guilty of taking figures from history and massaging the facts a little. So we're going to take a tour of national myths now, starting with our correspondent in Serbia, Guy Delaunay, with his profile of something of a cult figure who spent a good few hundred years as part of the Balkan state's pop history.
If you're wondering which historical figure dominates Serbian life, look no further than Saint Sava. Admittedly, that means going back to the 12th and 13th centuries, but it has to be said that he lived a remarkable life. Prince, cleric, poet, pilgrim, scholar, diplomat, Sava was a bit of an overachiever. He got off to a good start by being born into the royal family, but there were few indulgences for Sava. After becoming a monk, he facilitated peace between his warring brothers, founded the Serbian Orthodox Church, and became the country's educator and proselytizer in chief, and ultimately the personification of the Serb nation. His cultural masterstroke was rebranding the traditional pagan feast days, or Slava, as occasions to honour particular Christian saints. Even now, each family has a saint's day, which they observe with a bacchanalian three-day knees-up, and the biggest Slava of all is in honour of Saint Sava, when the songs praising his name are rolled out across TV screens and classrooms alike.
Bacchanalians slavering over St. Sava there in Serbia. Now let's leave the Balkans and head up across the Baltic Sea to Finland. Monocle's Marcus Hippi gives us his profile of a cultural figure from that country, which is a firm fixture in its cultural output.
In Finland, there is one historical figure we see on TV and in popular culture all the time. That is Carl Gustaf Emil Mannerheim, who was Commander-in-Chief of Finland's Defence Forces during the Second World War and the President of Finland almost straight after. Mannerheim became almost a godlike figure during the turmoils of the World War II and Finland's bloody war against the Soviet Union, and that reputation hasn't faded away. Just a few years ago, he was ranked to be the greatest Finn of all times in a public vote. Finns love war films about the Second World War, and when we see Mannerheim as a strong leader, that is absolutely fine. But artists love to bring up taboos, and that is why we have seen rather surprising depictions of Mannerheim on the Finnish TV recently. There was a film where Mannerheim was black and all the events took place in Africa. But what caused more controversy was an animation shown on TV where we saw a gay version of our war hero Mannerheim wearing a soldier's helmet and a women's corset having sex with a man. It caused a public outrage and, rather unsurprisingly, hasn't been broadcast on the national channels ever again.
Was Marcus talking about?
Marcus Hippi, that was. On Finland, Carl Gustaf Emil Mannerheim. And
who?
Now... Do you want to say it again? Carl Gustav Emil Mannerheim.
Thank you.
I can do this all night. And now to Istanbul, where our bureau chief Sophie Grove gives her profile of a 16th century sultan who, whether on stage, the page or the screen, is still remembered in Turkish culture.
Suleiman was the longest reigning sultan, in charge from 1520 to 1566. He oversaw an Ottoman golden age and was known for the opulence of his court and for his chief concubine, Roxolana, a converted Christian, the daughter of an Orthodox priest and former slave. Though he excelled in many disciplines, goldsmithing, art and poetry, and for expanding the Ottoman Empire to the gates of Vienna, Suleiman is often remembered, in art at least, for his decadent lifestyle. Suleiman was painted by Titian in around 1530 and has since inspired music, literature and pop, and countless biographies. Roxolana too has inspired, even a symphony by Haydn. More recently, the blockbuster Turkish-made TV series Magnificent Century depicted the daily life of Suleiman's court, and largely the politics between his wife, concubines, mother, sisters and children. Magnificent Century drew record audiences, but also critiques from Turkey's ruling elite. It was denounced by the then Prime Minister Erdogan for its content. He would prefer the Sultan to be known for his conquering armies rather than his lavish, often salacious harem.
Sophie Grove there, our bureau chief in Istanbul, with her take on Turkey's longest reigning sultan. Finally to France and our correspondent there, Tom Burgess-Watson. Who, Muller, who do you think he's profiled?
Genghis Khan.
Let's find out.
Every year, on the second Sunday of May, people right across France stop to honour Joan of Arc, saint, national heroine and one of the world's most famous military leaders. Following a series of visions in her early teenage years, she became convinced that her calling in life was to rid France of its enemies. She took a vow of chastity, cut her hair short, dressed as a man, and went on to lead France to numerous victories, most famously at Orléans, where her forces delivered a humiliating defeat to the English in 1429. It was a turning point in the Hundred Years' War, but a year later she was captured and sold to the English. Her life came to an end in 1431 when she was only 19, burned at the stake in Rouen in northern France, accused by her captors and their French collaborators of being a heretic. Well, nearly 600 years since her death, she remains an enduring symbol of French unity and nationalism, immortalized by hundreds of works of art, literature, theatre, film and music. A golden statue of her, on her horse, carrying a flag into battle, enjoys a prominent position in the central Paris square, which France's Front National and other far-right political organisations often use as a focal point for their rallies.
Tom Burgess-Watson there, complete with accordion in France, talking about Joan of Arc and her place in French pop history and culture. Not Genghis Khan, Andrew Muller, who apparently is one of your favourites.
It was a stab in the dark, I confess. My knowledge of French history is a little bit lackadaisical. Genghis Khan wasn't French then.
Really?
Well, is this what you're telling me?
Well, you said that your knowledge of French history isn't so good, but clearly your knowledge of Genghis Khan could do with improving as well.
Apparently.
So, if you were massaging the facts when it came to a sort of a childhood historical hero, who would it have been?
All countries do this. I mean, Australia, probably the most massaged figure in our history is Ned Kelly, who was an illiterate horse thief and cop killer who has been elevated to the status of national hero.
The sort of men in tights thing of Robin Hood, let us say, in the United Kingdom.
Yeah, except he was, in defence of my people, a man in a really quite, you know, impressive homemade suit of armour rather than tights.
We never know, you see. This is the whole thing when we have the revisionists come in.
The key question at this point, if we're discussing the relative mythological outlaws of Australia and England, is who would win in a fight between Ned Kelly and Robin Hood? And
obviously, Robin Hood.
Ned Kelly's got a gun and a suit of armour. Robin Hood has a bow and arrow and a pair of tights. It's Ned Kelly all day.
Yeah, but Robin Hood had the best looking girl. And he had his merry band of brothers men.
Well, also Ned Kelly actually existed, so he has that advantage.
But you see, Robin Hood may well have existed.
It's only going one way.
Which way?
It's all Ned. all day. Anyway, coming up in the next half hour on The Daily, we will be taking a look at the headlines from Asia. We will be hearing about a case of buyer's remorse in Rio and finding out why pets are set to get their own terminal at JFK if only humans could.
But first, Suzanne has the latest headlines.
Thank you, Emma. Ukraine has accused Russia of sending 9,000 troops and 500 tanks across their shared border to join pro-separatist rebels in the east. The Ukrainian military says it's fighting Russian soldiers near the eastern city of Luhansk. Moscow has denied the move. The government in France has announced an increase on security spending to prevent more terror attacks in the wake of the Paris shootings. More than €420 million will be used to recruit more than 2,600 personnel who will bolster services in police, justice, intelligence and defence. In Israel, at least 10 people have been stabbed in an apparent terror attack on a bus in Tel Aviv. The government says a Palestinian man who was shot in the leg as he tried to escape was to blame. And the leader of the fast-growing German anti-Muslim movement, Pegida, has resigned tonight after a photo emerged of him posing as Hitler. Prosecutors were also investigating Lutz Bachmann over allegations he incited hatred when he called refugees scumbags. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to the Monocle Daily with me, Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson. Now, as we attempted to discuss earlier before we were thwarted by a dodgy telephone line, an interesting diplomatic experiment started today, the beginning of the end of 6 decades of official silence between the United States and Cuba.
So, Girish Gupta, Monocle's contributor in Caracas, soon on their way to Cuba. We were trying to establish whether these talks, Girish, were nothing more than an exercise in how to manage your expectations.
Oh, that's very interesting. I mean, today was the first day of these public talks. I remember a lot of the talks between Cuba and the US over the last 50 years, even not just the last 18 months or so, have been at dinner parties, have been at drinks events, that sort of thing. These back channel methods, as opposed to these public talks with photographers and that we're talking about now. There were, however, a little bit of a clash today. Though on the first day of these public talks, it was over the so-called wet foot, dry foot policy, which is a lovely name for the immigration policy for the United States for Cuban citizens. And I'm sure your listeners are aware of the infamous images of rafts, makeshift rafts made of wood or old floating cars that people used to try to get from Havana or elsewhere in Cuba, to Florida, which is just 90 miles away. The idea was that if the US Coast Guard caught them in the sea, i.e. their feet were wet, they'd be sent back to Cuba. Yet if they'd managed to get a foot on dry land, they were allowed in. The US wants to maintain this policy. Cuba is not so keen. They say Josefina Vidal, who's leading the Cuba side, says this promotes illegal immigration, people trafficking, and of course these dangerous journeys across the Florida Straits. So there were clashes, and things are going to be difficult over these talks.
How nervous do you get the sense, or otherwise, I guess, that the Cubans are about this? Because this is a rather higher stakes negotiation for them. They presumably are trying to find a way that they can normalise relations with Washington without bringing down the regime.
Well, that's right. It is a very high stakes game for the Cubans. But in a sense now, because they've got the ball rolling and the ball is rolling publicly, I think that's the big issue here. The ball is rolling publicly. People know about this. People want this to happen. The Cuban government, the Castros, realise that their economic model wasn't working. They realised a couple of years ago that Venezuela, for example, wasn't able to pump in the oil and essentially the hard currency that Cuba needed to survive. And they didn't want to return to what they call the special period after the fall of the Soviet Union, when Cuba just had absolutely no money. So they know that that the US can obviously help with this. But obviously Cuba has its own demands as well, and it is delicate, and they don't want to lose their own government. Cuba needs to get itself off the state sponsors of terrorism list. Symbolically, that's a huge deal, of course, but economically it's really important, because you've got these big multinational companies that want to deal with Cuba, that want to pour money in, and then they see that that Cuba's on this list, and they realise that if their money is flowing through the US, which of course for a lot of multinationals it is, they might have it confiscated. They don't want to deal with that. So getting off that list will be really, really important for Cuba and also for the US. It doesn't really mean anything. Everyone knows, I think, in the US administration that Cuba shouldn't really be on the state sponsors of terrorism list. But then the US also has its own demands. It wants to get its embassy open. They've currently got the special interest section, and that's this huge six-story building on the Malecón, the gorgeous waterfront in Havana. It's very imposing, and in fact, it's quite an interesting building. Fidel used to call it the nest of spies. And in, I think, 2006, George W. Bush installed this. He installed a news ticker on it, and it would throw out these pro-democracy messages, Martin Luther King quotes, that sort of thing. And it was essentially to annoy the Cuban government. And then in response, the Cubans put up these, I think it was 138 huge black flags, and they served two purposes. Firstly, it destroyed the wonderful view that the US diplomats had of the Florida Straits, but it also covered up the news ticker itself.
Girish, I'm terribly sorry, we're going to have to leave it there. We were delighted to get the phone line up, so thank you very much indeed for joining us on Monocle 24.
And it's time now for a preview of this week's edition of The Urbanist. In Rio de Janeiro, as you drive out to the future Olympic Village in the west zone of Barra, you can't help but notice Cidade das Artes, the fantastical concrete structure designed by French architect Christian de Portzamparc, is South America's largest modern concert hall, and at 90,000 square metres, it's hard to miss.
But Cidade das Artes took years longer than expected to open, and the final price tag blew out to around six times the original budget. It prompted many to ask if it was even worth building. Monocle's Rio de Janeiro correspondent Sheena Rossiter visited Cidades de Artes to find out what this musical shrine means to Cariocas.
Stepping inside Cidade das Artes, you can't help but be impressed. The fantastical structure is both impressive in size and design, mixing the look and feel of the Brazilian modernist movement with a touch of European influence. With 12 practice rooms and several concert halls, the modernist structure is a dream come true for any musician or lover of classical music. But Cidade das Artes, which was originally known as Cidade da Música, wasn't built without controversy. Aside from the fact that the project took over a decade to build, the final bill came in an estimated six times higher than what was originally budgeted for. And it was all built with public money.
When the new mayor assumed this building, this Cidade da Música, in the first place, he changed the name for Cidade das Artes.
André Nadeo is a journalist for Terra, an online news portal in Brazil. He wrote about Cidade das Artes and explains why it attracted so much public attention.
Cidade da Música, in the first place, was an idea of the former mayor of Rio de Janeiro. His name is Cesar Maia. In the first place, it was designed in November 2002. So originally, this supposed to cost public money, let's not forget about that, 8 million reais, what in pounds would be like around 18 million pounds. So at that time, didn't count that many attention. It was cool. People were like, fine. In Barra da Tijuca, it would be nice, a nice place for people like going to the theater, have some concerts. Well, one more option of entertainment here in Rio de Janeiro. But the thing is, with the passing of the years, this money has been increased a lot. So, in 10 years, from 2002, from 2012, Rio de Janeiro has spent 500 million reais, which costs, let's say, like around 75 million pounds, let's say like this. So, of course, called the attention of the population, and a lot of people were criticizing about this. Because, do we need this? We are running out of, for example, money from education, from public transportation. Because of this fact, about this huge amount of public money, the news, all the people are starting to look more at this.
There is a positive side, though, to Cidade das Artes. It's now become home for around 100 of Brazil's classical musicians. 30-year-old Rafael Paixão is one of them. He plays the trombone in the Brazilian Symphony Orchestra. In fact, he's the lead trombone in the orchestra, which now calls Cidade das Artes home since March of last year. Before then, the OSB was homeless. As Rafael shows me around Cidade das Artes, he explains why the building, despite the controversy, is so important to him.
Yeah, for me it's very important because now the orchestra has a house, and for us it's very, very important to create our identity, our sound, and to improve our technique as a musician. As a person, it's very, very good to have a place to rehearse. It's very important to have a big house or a big place like this with many different halls, with electroacoustic hall, with a chamber music hall, with a big hall, and also a library. So it's a cultural space that everyone can use.
With the OSB calling Cidade das Artes home for just under a year now, not all concerts sell out. But as the orchestra turns 75 this year, musicians like Rafael are hoping that the turnout will improve when the orchestra starts playing again in March.
I take this opportunity to invite everyone to come to attend the concerts.
So the fallout of all this, after all said and done, cariocas are getting more culture and Cidade das Artes is starting to be used more often, just a short 13 years after the project was proposed. But what happened to the investigations into potential corruption over the inflated price of Cidade das Artes?
Nothing happened at all. I mean, they made those kind of investigations, but let's just forget about it. Because these people who make the fiscalization, of course, they send some like notes to the mayor, but just Eduardo Paes said, there's nothing to do about me. This is something I'm just dealing with now. I mean, this is not my problem. So, of course, this is my problem, but now, I mean, it's not my fault. So basically, Cesar Maia has not been prosecuted, not even the people who used to work with him in that time. People just forget about that. Nowadays, we have some theaters, some concerts, but I mean, people just don't talk about it anymore. It's just an example of how those kind of buildings, how those infrastructures, those huge infrastructures, there's a lot of cases of corruption here in Brazil. So one more time, shame on us.
With inflated infrastructure costs starting to rear their ugly heads from World Cup infrastructure, and even more recently in the ongoing Lava Jato car wash scandal that has plagued Brazil's state-run oil company for the past year, Cidade das Artes just seems to be one of many cases in Brazil where building costs have soared purely to line the pockets of those in power. But at least we're left being able to listen to some beautiful music. For Monocle, in Rio de Janeiro, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
That was Monocle's Sheena Rossiter reporting from Rio there. You can hear the rest of The Urbanist tomorrow at 1900 hours London time, or any time after that, if you so choose, on our website or on iTunes.
Coming up, our review of the Asian newspapers. Do stay tuned.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
6:45 in Kuala Lumpur, 22:45 here in London. Time now to take a look at the Asian newspapers. We're joined once again by Ramon Pacheco Pardo, lecturer in international relations at King's College London and associate of the Lao China Institute. Ramon, welcome back. The first story you've brought us in, this is from Japan News. Japan's defense minister, Jen Nakatani, is visiting UN peacekeeping operations in South Sudan, which include... Well, they're officially known, because it's Japan, as ground self-defense forces. But you could, of course, argue that if they're in South Sudan, they are...
How much self-defense are the Japanese engaged in?
Exactly. Difficult to see how that is a direct defense of Japan's national interest. But, of course, the backdrop here is Shinzo Abe's slightly more expansive idea of what the Japanese defense forces should be doing.
Absolutely. And obviously, he won the elections recently. And he wants to pass a bill that will make the self-defense forces really look like a proper military force. It didn't look like one so far up to now. So the problem here is that these self-defense forces, they are deployed in many different places, including Somalia, for example. And this is a war mission. This is not even a peacekeeping, peacebuilding, or emergency relief mission. And obviously, within Japan, but obviously in other countries in Asia, South Korea, China, there is a lot of fear that this might lead to Japan having a proper military force.
Well, I mean, this would be all well and good were the past few days' events not have overtaken things. First and foremost, a promise of $200 million in aid to help with the fight against Islamic State without actually them having to combat and, you know, participate in any direct combat. And then, of course, the emergence of two Japanese nationals clearly held hostage by Islamic State. I mean, when you start putting that in the wider context and you start looking at the operations in South Sudan, is there a sense that there's a cumulative effect here, that lots and lots of little operations by Japan suddenly make out to be, you know, one rather big, large movement by Shinzo Abe?
Yes, and not only this, obviously, while they are conducting these operations, they are basically being trained on the ground, and they are conducting operations on the ground, so they are getting experience that could be used in the future closer to Japan. So the main issue here is that the self-defense forces themselves, prior to the 2000s, they had very little experience being deployed overseas. Now they have the experience, and as we see with the kidnapping case that you have mentioned, men in Japan think, well, we are part of this global community that's been threatened by, in this case, by terrorism from the Islamic State. Therefore, we should be more engaged. But on the other hand, obviously, this would go against Japan's peace clause in the constitution if eventually these forces become involved in war scenarios.
As you correctly point out, Shinzo Abe won the election, and he didn't make any secret of his desire that Japan should project itself much as a, I guess, for want of a less pejorative expression, normal country would. But how nervous or otherwise is there a lot of nervousness about that idea among Japanese people? Have they got used to the idea that we are a peaceful country, our defense force is a self-defense force?
Well, there is a very big divide in Japan, and many people in the opposition are pointing out that Abe won the election not because of his talk about reforming the constitution, but because of his Abenomics, or because of his economic policy. So somehow this was secondary during the campaign. This is what the opposition is pointing out. Abe is obviously saying, well, it was part of my manifesto, and if people voted for it, I should implement these changes. So there is a very big divide within Japan, and the two positions, the two groups seem to have ever more distant positions. They don't seem to be reaching an agreement on how the Japanese military should look like.
Right, let us move on then to the South China Morning Post. Hundreds of Chinese seeking, in inverted commas, jihad training are caught on Vietnam border in 1 year, according to Beijing. Ramon, who are these jihadis?
Well, they are suspected to have joined the East Turkmenistan Islamic Movement in the Xinjiang province of China, and they are suspected of trying to overthrow basically the government in Beijing, or at least in Xinjiang, through the use of terrorism.
I mean, but the Beijing revealed last night is the key quote here, I think, in the South China Morning Post. Obviously, Beijing has a vested interest in trying to flam up the idea of militant jihadism at large among the Uyghur people. How seriously do we take this, really?
I think there is an agreement that there are some terrorists operating in Xinjiang, and like there are in many other places that are being trained in different countries, Vietnam, for example, Afghanistan, Pakistan. But at the same time, as I think you're suggesting, this is being overplayed by Beijing. I mean, the threat is being overblown as a way of trying to repress movements that in other countries would be legal, that are just seeking more autonomy for the region, not necessarily even the independence of the region. And within the East Turkmenistan Islamic movement, there are many, most of the people who belong to this movement are actually peaceful. They don't really want to engage in terrorism or any other activity.
So to what degree have these individuals now been pushed into a sort of more instantly recognizable narrative, insofar as we're being told that they are engaged in jihadi training? I mean, immediately you think Islamic State, but actually no, this is nothing of the sort.
No, absolutely, it's very different. But it is true that since 9/11, Beijing has been pushing for this narrative. And now, for example, the US, even the European Union, they do agree with Beijing that there seems to be a terrorist threat within China. But as I said before, probably this is being overblown by the Chinese government in any case.
We should look finally it's a weird story. This is a row between North Korea and the United States about it was a book that became quite well known, Escape from Camp 14, written by an American journalist, Blaine Harden, based on the accounts of Shin Dong-hyuk, allegedly the only person born and raised in a North Korean prison camp who sort of escaped to tell about it. We're now in this weird area where there's now doubt raised on some of the things said in the book, but it seems almost idle to discuss that, doesn't it? It seems like a very minor detail, because obviously there is or are ghastly human rights abuses being perpetrated in North Korea. Will this argument let Pyongyang off the hook a little bit?
I don't think it will let Pyongyang off the hook, but I think the problem here is that some of these North Koreans who have escaped the country, they have been used in the past, and it has been found out that their stories have been exaggerated. Like this one, for example, there was a girl recently, a girl 21, 22, who had also exaggerated her story, and in Korean television she told a different story from what she said later on in English. So the problem is that some of these refugees are actually being used. And even though human rights abuses are taking place in North Korea, North Korea can actually point out, well, these people are lying, and part of what they say is actually untrue. So therefore, this plays in favor of the North Korean government. If they weren't exaggerating the story, there would be no doubts that what is going on in North Korea are human rights abuses, and some North Koreans maybe should be prosecuted, or at the very least, they should be indicted in war tribunals.
Ramon Pacheco Pardo, lecturer in international relations at King's College London, thank you very much for joining us.
Broadcasting around the clock from our headquarters at Midori House in London, Monocle 24 is the global radio service of Monocle magazine and a wholly owned subsidiary of Wing Content. With bureau in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Istanbul, Zurich, New York and Toronto, and a network of over 35 correspondents, Monocle 24 is edited by Tyler Brulee, Andrew Tuck, Steve Bloomfield and Tom Edwards. If you have any editorial, programming or advertising inquiries, please contact us at info@monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. It is indeed little consolation to those of us who've recently flown halfway around the world in economy class. But on any aeroplane you fly on, however scarce the legroom and however unidentifiable the food, there are creatures worse off, those flying in what could literally be described as cattle class.
Unless, of course, you are a cow. Because animals, whether pets, livestock, zoo animals or sports creatures, fly cargo. But from next year, those doing so from New York's JFK Airport will at least have a more comfortable experience on the ground. JFK will host the world's first privately owned dedicated terminal for animals. And yes, it will be called the Ark. Well, joining us from New York is Cliff Bollman, an architect at Gensler, one of the firms behind the terminal's design. Cliff is on site at JFK now. Cliff, how exciting for you. What's it looking like when you are? Have you started to build your Ark?
Good evening. No, we haven't started. We are in the design process and look forward to building the first and one-of-its-kind terminal for animals.
How different is, and you know, there's any number of obvious jokes you could make about the catering for human beings at JFK Airport, but how different is designing a terminal for animals than designing one for two-legged passengers?
Well, we're going to use a lot of our own knowledge of designing terminals for people and start to apply that for terminals for animals. You know, people treat their animals sometimes better than they treat themselves. So we're using a lot of those cues and clues to help inform how we're going to design this terminal.
The differences are clearly obvious, but to what degree do you have similar requirements for an animal airport terminal to a human one? One of the immediate things that I think of is, to what degree does an animal have to pass through security?
So the we're always focused on the well-being of the animal. So this is really to find ways to reduce that stress on the animal, on the owner, on the its guardian that passed through the airport, and to find ways to create a more comfortable travel experience for the animal.
And presumably JFK, like all major airports, already has facilities for loading animals on and off aircraft. Will this be a facility for which people need to pay a premium? Is this basically the frequent flyer lounge for animals?
So this is an independent company that's operating a service on the airport and for the public, and it, you know, they can choose multiple different ways to transport that animal, whether it's in country or out of country.
Not wishing to come over a little bit too Orwellian, but are some animals more equal than others when it comes to airport departure?
I think all animals are sort of treated in an equal and humane way. It's really, really focused on providing a stress-less travel experience for those animals.
But in terms of the sort of the physical and the practical provision that must be made, surely if you have something like, I have no idea, I'm thinking off the top of my head, a dolphin, that's going to require a little bit more thinking on behalf of you than it is perhaps to get a herd of sheep.
Yeah, I mean, in this case, we're really focused on dogs, cats, birds, horses, cattle, and so we're bringing a lot of those experts to the table to help us design barns for the horses, for instance. It will contain about 80 stalls inside an existing cargo building, and there's an entire pen for the cattle. I'm working with Professor Temple Grandin, to understand how cattle would pass in the least stressful environment.
Cliff Bowman, architect at global design firm Gensler, one of the firms behind the ARC at JFK. Thank you very much indeed, and we wish you the very best of luck.
And that's all we have time for on this edition of The Daily. The show is produced by Alice Block. The researchers were Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Henry Rees Sheridan. Our studio manager was Joel Church.
Next up is the latest news from Suzanne Chislett, and then after that, Fernando Augusto Pacheco will keep you company with The Pacific Shift. The Globalist will kick off the day in Europe in 7 hours' time. Your hosts for that will be Victoria Graham and Dominic Reynolds.
Emma and I will be back with The Daily at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Andrew Muller.
And from me, Emma Nelson.
It's good night. Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye.